If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, visit the Canadian Center on Substance Use and Addiction website at ccsa.ca. They have a list of helplines for each province in Canada. You can also find more help and resources at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health at camh.ca. You are listening to No Justice with the John Howard Society of Saskatchewan. Conversations around justice and advocacy for those at risk of injustice. Hi everyone, welcome to the No Justice Podcast. I'm your host, Blair Roberts. On today's episode, we're going to explore the connection between addiction and incarceration, with a focus on the impact that it has on families. In 2020 alone, 4,395 lives were lost to overdose across the country. There are many factors that can lead to someone having an overdose, but it often includes either contaminated drugs or a user taking more and more of that drug to meet their increasing need as the tolerance to the drug increases. All too often, serious addiction issues lead to people ending up in our criminal justice system. Once they're in prison, there are few addiction supports available or plans put in place for inmates upon their release. What we often see is a cycle of recidivism. People commit crimes to fuel their drug habit, they end up in prison, then back on the streets without support, where the process often repeats itself. Drug addiction is a public health crisis, and too often it's treated as simply a crime problem, something that we can arrest our way out of, and we know that doesn't work. According to the Canadian Center on Substance Use and Addiction, data indicates that about 7 of 10 offenders in the federal correctional system have engaged in problematic use of alcohol and other drugs during the one-year period prior to their incarceration. It's not hard to extrapolate from this the role that drugs play in crime. Whether by overdose or incarceration, lives are lost to addiction and things don't seem to be getting better. People end up overdosing or in prison, and their families are left behind, often with broken hearts trying to figure out how things possibly went so wrong. Today we have the honor of talking with some folks who have been deeply impacted by this issue. They're going to share a little bit about the work that they do, the experiences they've had, and about how it feels to lose a family member to drug addiction.
How's it going? Oh, yeah, not too bad, I guess. You guys got rained on a little bit, it looks like. Yeah.
It's August 31st, and today is International Overdose Awareness Day. I went down to the legislature to join Prairie Harm Reduction for a public demonstration which was meant to grab people's attention. They placed 1,600 crosses on the lawn to represent the 1,600 lives that have been lost to overdose in Saskatchewan since they started keeping statistics. I met with Jason McCurdy, Executive Director at Prairie Harm Reduction in Saskatoon. Prairie Harm Reduction opened the first safe consumption site in Saskatchewan about a year ago. They've been tireless advocates for those who struggle with addiction in our province.
So we're a nonprofit based in Saskatoon. We run currently the province's only safe consumption site. We have a drop-in center that caters to people who are, you know, experiencing addiction, homeless, living with or at risk of HIV. And then we also run an apartment building for families that are at risk of having their kids apprehended. They can move in with us and then we support them through that. And we have our family support program that does outreach. And then we also now run a youth home for at-risk youth. And then we have naloxone training available, professional development education, that type of stuff around harm reduction, service delivery, working with people with active addictions, and then we do advocacy as well, and we also run a clothing store.
Cool. A lot of stuff on the go for you guys.
Yeah. That's cool.
Why did you guys drive down from Saskatoon to the legislature today? Why are we here?
So it's International Overdose Awareness Day. You know, Saskatchewan is in a tough spot with the overdose crisis. You know, we have more people dying of overdose year over year. 2021's on record to be our worst year ever for overdose deaths, and we don't really have a government that seems willing to budge on it. And so we wanted to show a visual of what this actually means, you know, when there's over 1,600 deaths since 2010 and the problem's getting worse year over year. We wanted to let families know that we see them, we hear them, we haven't forgot them, and we're going to make sure that government knows that this is a major issue and they need to take it seriously. And having this visual representation, I think, is important because a lot of times people get lost and they forget how many people there are, but they forget that these are individuals. And for every cross that's here, that's not just that person, but that's their family and friends that have been impacted by their death. And, you know, that can take a long time for somebody to process that and grieve. And so we wanted to make sure that it's present here in Regina. And if we held an event in Saskatoon, I don't think it'd have quite the impact as if we came down at their ledge here in Regina.
How do you see harm reduction working in prison? Could it work the same as it does within your walls?
Oh yeah, definitely. You can have needle exchanges in prison. You could have safe consumption sites in prisons. You should even have safe supply programs in prisons. Somebody shouldn't detox in prison and then they're not really getting the supports they need. And so when they leave, they're still going back to that life of addiction. And what you end up happening is people are much more likely to overdose because they're drug naive now, but they still have the same addictions that they had going in. And so you have people, you know, with active addictions, they're using 10 milligrams of Dilaudid a day before they went in. They get out. A lot of times people don't taper their dose because they're not even given that harm reduction education in the institutions. And so they're coming out and going right back to 10 milligrams. Well, there was a chance to overdose before. Now with fentanyl mixed in with drugs, there's a much higher chance to overdose. I think those services need to be offered. Supreme Court of Canada said that those services need to be offered in federal institutions. They should be offered in provincial institutions. And at the very least, everybody leaving prison should be given a Narcan kit, you know, but we don't really see that right now. And so when folks are leaving, they should be given safe sex supplies, harm reduction supplies. Really, everybody leaving there should be trained and given a naloxone kit.
If you don't work in this field, or maybe even if you do, it might sound like a wild idea to have needle exchange and safe consumption sites within prison walls. It's a tough enough sell to people in our communities, let alone when someone is serving a sentence in prison. You might also wonder how drugs would even get into prison in the first place. Shouldn't it be more difficult to gain access to drugs while under 24-hour supervision? You would think so. But drugs are accessible everywhere. Wherever there is money to be made and those struggling with addictions, you'll find a market for drugs, even within prisons. Whatever your thoughts on harm reduction, we're asking you to just keep an open mind and try to see addiction through a health lens rather than a criminal lens. The goal of harm reduction is to keep people alive until they're ready and able to walk away.
What can the average person do to advocate for this?
One of the big things is you can get trained and educated on naloxone and then have those conversations, those dinner table conversations with your family. You can go to our website, prairiehr.ca. We have a letter writing campaign to the province asking them why they aren't funding harm reduction at a realistic level and actual harm reduction services like safe consumption sites. And then I think calling your MLAs and MPs and asking them what they're doing to stop overdose deaths, and don't just take them at their stock answer. You know, when you see overdose deaths climbing across this country, clearly what they're doing is not enough and they need to be really taking this seriously and investing in a serious level. If people want to know where to get naloxone in the province, they can just Google their home community and naloxone training. Website pops up. The province has a pretty good website actually to find out where you can get naloxone training in the province. If you're in Saskatoon, hit us up. We do free training and distribution, and we also have nasal naloxone on hand. So the province doesn't currently offer that, but we have that at our facility, and we can give you a free nasal naloxone as well.
For those who don't know, naloxone is a miracle of modern medicine. If someone overdoses, naloxone can be given as a shot or a nasal spray. While a person may still be at risk and should be given access to medical care as soon as possible, naloxone is responsible for saving many people's lives. I wanted to talk to people who have had experience with drug addiction in the justice system to find out the impact that it had on their lives.
You know, the first thing I like to let people know too is that I grew up in a really good home. Like, I had, my parents were together, they had good jobs, any activity I wanted to play, I could. We always had food in the fridge, there was no abuse. I had a really loving family, a huge family, like my fourth cousins were at Christmas, you know, so very connected as a kid.
This is Megan. Megan works for John Howard Society of Saskatchewan. She's been an advocate for those struggling with addiction, having dealt with addiction herself. Megan was recently featured in a documentary called Stop Mething Around.
Both sets of grandparents were alive, so that was one of my favorite places to be, was out on a farm with animals, with my cousins. And I did really well in school, played soccer, was always very competitive in sports. went to Catholic schools, was a sheltered kid, and then I hit high school. I went from being in a class of 30 to a class of 300 trying to fit in. And then that's when the experimenting with using, and so it started really young. I started, you know, marijuana and alcohol. And like by 15 years old, I had started using ecstasy. At 16, it was crystal meth. 15 years old, I got my first trafficking charge. I was caught, you know, with like 8,000 pills of ecstasy. That's when it started to become apparent that I had a drug problem. There's always people that say, oh, get your kids involved, and then they won't turn to drugs. Well, my first ecstasy pill came from a member of my soccer team. So I think that that's a stereotype too. And I think where the disease of addiction plays in is that at 18, most of my friends quit drugs and they went on to university, ended up going on to getting jobs and having families, whereas I couldn't put the drug down. So it's like almost like Russian roulette.
Right. Who's it going to grab? Who's it going to hold on
to? Yeah.
How do you kind of make the jump from a user to dealing?
I grew up in Yorkton, and in the city that I was living in, I started to hang out with the older kids, so like the grade 12s when I was grade 9. I was introduced to kids that were like, I call them kids, but they're like 22, 23, 24 years old and still partying. I had all these men that would be like, you know, if you want drugs, because I didn't have much money. Like I was a high school kid. If you want drugs, you need to do this sexual favor. And I got sick of that and I didn't want to hear that anymore. So I decided to become the drug dealer. I can't really pinpoint. I knew I was dating this guy who worked on the rigs in Edmonton. I went up on the rigs. I had been suspended or expelled from school for like the multiple time. And my parents were trying to put some strict rules. So I jumped on a bus back when the buses still went. He had paid the bus ticket and I went up to the rigs. You know, he had a high paying job out there and I met some of his coworkers and they were major drug dealers. So I was connected instantly.
About where in this experience did you start to get involved with the justice system? When did that start and what was that experience like for you?
So it started at 14. I started hanging out with the kids that had been expelled from school. And I was just smoking weed at the time, but they didn't have licenses. They would be driving and get pulled over and then I'd get brought home in a cop car. And it was innocent, like not innocent, but it was like small things in the beginning. Or I had a marijuana pipe on me. So I'd get, you know, they'd confiscate that, call my parents. I got caught siphoning gas for a friend out of a vehicle. And, you know, it was just little things like that. And then all of a sudden, I started to sell the drugs. And now I was already known by the police just for being somebody that was always brought home to their parents. When I got caught with all those ecstasy pills, that was the big arrest. And then after that, I was constantly being pulled over or just, I guess, in a small city, being kind of harassed. I think I racked up like 30 breaches. And like my family, they paid for a lawyer, so I didn't have to go with legal aid. I thought we were doing the right thing by doing that, but everything was about hiding my addiction and I had a problem and that, you know, we got to hide that. You're a good kid, come from a good family. We're going to hide all this, you know. So then it kind of taught me at a young age, hey, if I hide it, I can get away with it and get a slap on the wrist. I know that my family had reached out to the schools, had reached out to mental health and addictions. They had reached out to all these places. Mind you, we did live in a small city at the time, but there was nothing available. They had one, like, it was like a group session that talked about addictions, but I mean, I was selling drugs and doing drugs with the people on the smoke breaks. There just wasn't many services that were available. Had there been a program like the drug treatment corridor, more of like a restorative justice sort of thing, maybe I could have identified that I had an addiction problem back then.
At 18 years old, Megan spent 9 months in prison. It was very difficult. There wasn't much programming available as she detoxed off of her meth addiction. She was offered methadone, but had heard from a friend that it was much worse than a needle addiction, so she passed. I asked her what it was like to detox in prison.
They have somebody that comes maybe every hour or 2 hours to check while you're in city cells, kind of. So I spent 3 or 4 days in city cells first, sleeping it off, but you don't get the medical treatment. Withdrawing from certain drugs can be actually fatal if not properly monitored. So you don't get that when you go to jail. It's kind of like rolling the dice. After I became an adult and I kept spending time in prisons and like I did do a lot of like couple months stints where it was remand time and then I'd get out, I'd have completely good intentions. Like first 2-3 weeks, I'm sleeping it off. The first 2-3 weeks is detox for me. And then after that, I start to think about why I'm there and, you know, I'm going to be good when I get out. I like if my family's answering me, I'm making plans. But then, you know, I go back out and all of a sudden I can't get a job because I have a record. Right. Can't find a house because I have a huge gap on my resume and a huge gap on my like where were where have you been living? Well, you know, Pine Grove Correctional.
good luck. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, those hinder you, and then you kind of get to the point where when you're all by yourself and you don't have a support system out there, you're all by yourself. So you just give up. You hit the give up button, we'll call it. And you go back out to what you know. So it's a health condition. You know, like I truly believe it's a disease and it's a health condition. And if we treated people that were suffering from this health condition like we do every other health condition, you know, maybe there would be some changes. I have a few friends that have passed away because they went to jail. So they're clean for a couple years or whatever. Maybe they were getting drugs in there, but they're not as strong in there as they are on the street. And then when they get out, they use for the very first time and they pick up where they left off before they went in and they overdose and die. And I think just having that education there, especially with naloxone and Narcan, like we could be doing training in there, totally could be doing training in there, having that training. And then knowing that if you're going to use when you get out, make sure you use around people so that there's somebody that can bring you back, or like so that you're not by yourself. It's a reality for some people, right? Like they don't have that support system when they get out. It's kind of funny because I was very much against harm reduction when I first started getting clean. I'm like, no, complete abstinence. I had a girl tell me, well, Megan, safe injection sites kept me alive long enough to find recovery. Instantly, my mind changed, because if it saves one person's life and we have those tools available to people, we need to keep them alive. We need to keep people alive long enough to find recovery. I'll admit it, like my sister is struggling with a fentanyl addiction. She wants treatment right now. She wants to get help, but nothing is available to her right this second. So if we're going to be against her getting naloxone, Narcan, safe injection, like then we need to have stuff ready for people right now when they're ready. And we don't.
What is drug court? How did you get involved in drug court?
Drug court saved my life. I love to tell people this. Like I said, I've been in and out of jail my whole life. When I went to jail the last go around, I went to a sweat and I talked to an Indigenous elder there. And, you know, I wish I could go back and tell her how much she changed my life. But, you know, she taught me to pray for guidance and like to ask for the tools to change instead of like asking just to get out of jail. And so, you know, I got on my knees. I had a huge surrender in jail this last go around and I begged for a new way of life. And the very next day I was told that I was being accepted into this program called Drug Treatment Court. And they told me I was going to be released. You'll be on the bus later this afternoon and Tuesday you'll be released. But I'm still an addict. And so my first thought was to get on the phone and call the dope guy to meet me at the courthouse, because my thinking hadn't changed. That doesn't change just because I got on my knees and prayed. I ended up getting released. So it's a 16-month program. I was mandated to live at Kate's Place. It's a women's house in Regina, amazing house. And this little lady, Arlette, she's like the little mama of the house. She gets out. She's for such a tiny lady. Like she can be very intimidating. She's like, get in the car, get in the car. So I was too scared to make her mad. So I just jumped in the car. So I never got to meet the dope guy. And I have not used drugs since September 7th of 2017. So I'm coming up on 4 years.
Wow.
She took me, we filled out papers. I got in a little apartment. I could not believe my apartment. I went from sharing a cell in a jail that's falling apart. And like prior to that, I'd been on the streets for 2 years, homeless, shelters, sleeping on the park benches, couch surfing, to having my own place. Like that was just overwhelming. Yeah. And then she took me to drug court that afternoon. And so they have a building in Regina and it's awesome. And I think why the one in Regina works so well is because they have so many services that come right there. Because I got out on a Tuesday, Wednesday, a social worker was there to get me signed up for assistance and all that stuff, because you're not allowed to work in the first few months. And then that Thursday I got to see a doctor and I was sent for full checkups and all that. I was assigned an addictions counselor and there was a probation officer right there. So I never had to worry about going to all these other places, because that's half the battle when you don't have a car, is to get to all these appointments and then you end up missing a couple. But with everything in one roof, it's just awesome. You have to go to treatment while you're there. And it was there that I realized that I am an addict, because every time I pick up dope, I end up in jail. Like there's no middle. I don't put it down until I'm in jail. It has three tracks. And the last track, you have to be working or going to school. So I had already graduated high school. So I chose to go to university and take my business. I did it. Like I couldn't believe, like I thought that was something that was completely out of the cards. And, you know, drug court supported me the whole time. They still like check in with me. I check in with them. You know what? Here's the thing. You send somebody to the jail, it's just a school of criminals. That's what I say. All I got from jail was more trauma. I was disconnected from family that actually did care about me. And I met more friends that were not so healthy for me. Had they not given me drug court, I might be dead today, but I'd definitely still be in the life. Because I got drug court, I have a new way of life. I have a job. I contribute to society. I'm not committing crime. That's a huge thing. Like, I don't think for a guy using drugs should be a criminal. I don't think a police should be responding to that. I think an addictions counselor with consequences. We have a health problem here. Why drug court worked for me is because I had a safe home to live in while I attended drug court. A lot of these guys don't have safe homes. So I'm coming out of jail after, you know, a year and I'm sober, but I have to go live in a house where there's a crystal meth dealer across the hallway, a fentanyl dealer downstairs. Like, it's going to be hard for me to stay clean. I think safe housing, like supportive housing for people involved in the justice system, that's what we really need. When I came into drug court, I had burned every bridge with my family. My parents were barely talking to me because honestly, whenever I talked to them, I was like, I need a lawyer, you know, I need money. Like, I was very demanding. The only person who'd answer my calls is my auntie Roxy. She wouldn't give me money or nothing like that, but she'd answer my call every day at 7 o'clock. She would sit and wait for it. And she was a good support person for me when I first got into drug court. And then slowly, you know, she was probably reporting back to my mom and dad, but slowly I started to get all these family members back. My sister was very supportive of me. And now today, like, I have all the family members back in my life that I need. And the ones that I don't really need anymore because I'm at a place where I'm doing amazing and I'm taking accountability for my actions. And I guess, too, though, you have to recognize that not everybody has a supportive family. Some people have toxic families. I also had to put my recovery first. So in the very beginning, my family was learning how to set boundaries and how to follow them. And I also had to learn how to set boundaries, too, because no matter what, at the end of the day, my recovery has to come first. Or else I have nothing. Like, I always get told, like, oh, Megan, you're just a needle in a haystack. Like, not everyone will be like you. But that's not true. Like, I was the worst of the worst. And anybody on the street can recover if given the proper tools. I had all those tools given to me. I'm one of the very lucky few. But if we had more of those tools, more of those programs, more of the supports coming together, we'd see a lot more.
I'm Susan Collins. I live in Northern California, the wine country. I'm 71 years old, and probably the biggest thing in my life is I'm a grieving parent.
I met Susan by chance one day while I was scrolling through social media. Susan shared the story of her daughter, Oksana. I'm going to read some excerpts from Susan's blog post on the 2-year anniversary of losing Oksana. Two years ago today, it was a Friday. I went to work and after work I picked my daughter up and we went grocery shopping at Trader Joe's. She was going to cook dinner for her boyfriend. It was all so normal. I dropped her off at the top of the driveway at her house, said goodbye, and started to drive away. She stopped me because I hadn't said I love you. She leaned into the window. I told her I loved her and I kissed her goodbye. I can see her face, framed in the car window. I will see it forever. You never know which little moments in life will be seared into your memory. This one was. It was the last time I saw her alive. For 2 years, I've played that moment over and over in my mind. What could I have done to change the course of the next 24 hours? There must have been something I should have done. I was her mother. I was supposed to be able to protect her, to save her, again. And I couldn't, not this time. I want to reverse time. Go back and change something that would change what happened. Something that would allow me to have my daughter here with me. The reality is that there was nothing I could do. I'm trying to come to terms with that. It's not easy. So I sit here in tears, realizing I did the only thing I could. I told her I loved her, and I kissed her goodbye. I reached out to see if she would be interested in sharing the story on our podcast. Thankfully, she agreed. She hopes that by sharing Oksana's story, she can help someone else who's struggling in the same way.
I was a single parent to an adopted child. The loss of her is a significant impact on my life. Her name was Oksana. She was almost 3.5 years old when I adopted her, and she spent those 3.5 years in a Russian orphanage. She had a huge personality from the beginning. She was funny. She was smart. She was stubborn. I had wanted to change her name to Elizabeth and call her Libby. And I said to the social worker, is this going to be an issue? And she said, oh, absolutely not. I did that. And she started to call me Libby Mama, because clearly that's what you did in this country. And I enrolled her in preschool as Libby. And after a few months, another 3-year-old came up to me, very indignant, and said, she says her name's not Libby. And I talked to the teachers, and they said, well, when we sing our good morning song in the circle, she says Oksana. And when she wants something, she says Oksana, do it. Depending on her mood, if we call her Libby, she does not answer. At that point, I figured, if it's so important to her. So she was Oksana from that point on. She was very active. I put her in gymnastics before she turned 4, and she was a competitive gymnast until high school. She excelled at that.
How was Oksana introduced to drugs?
It really started once she quit gymnastics, because suddenly we had 16 to 20 hours a week available that was not occupied by a very structured activity. She always had some insecurities and attachment issues. Part of why she was in gymnastics, other than just physical talent, was to make her feel good about something. And towards the end, gymnastics got somewhat negative for her self-image. So she wasn't going into this with a great mindset. She was just looking for some security, I think. I asked her once what it was like the first time she did heroin. And she told me, it was like getting a warm hug, which is like, oh man, how do you deal with that? I think she dabbled at the end of high school, but then she got in with some kids who were doing more serious drugs. And she's very much like, I think, a lot of kids who got caught up with taking pills, started with the OxyContins. Those became much harder to get. And these kids all switched to heroin because they're addicted to opiates. You have to do something to keep the withdrawal away. At some point, it stops being about getting the high, and it's about keeping yourself from going into withdrawal.
At what point did she start to interact with the justice system?
She was pretty much under the radar until she got involved with someone else who had a higher drug profile, I guess, with the local police. And then you would have thought the two of them were like Bonnie and Clyde, the way they were treated by the police department. She was arrested multiple times. The only thing she was ever charged or convicted of was possession for personal use. So she wasn't dealing. It was basically just her addiction. They would get stopped. They would get hassled. She was in and out of jail. The system doesn't do them any good. Watching it from the outside and being pretty helpless to stop what was happening, just to see how they were very willing to use her, to manipulate her. Well, if you work for the task force, we'll, you know, step in and get your sentence reduced. With no concern for her. I mean, she was in her early 20s, very attractive. They want to wire her for sound and put her out there and do drug deals so that they can catch someone else. You know, they never really got any bigger fish as far as I could tell, but they were willing to sacrifice her to do that. Constant drug testing when she was on probation, police showing up at the house at like 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and they would tear her bedroom apart looking for something. I mean, sometimes it was the cap of a syringe. And I heard this directly. I was sitting in the room that they would use that to arrest her and have her probation revoked if she did not give them the names of all the dealers she knew. It was relentless. So the help, the support was just the fear of going back to jail. And if you're going back to jail, then the fear of having to go through a hard withdrawal. I think the whole system is wrong. I think you need to take the focus off of it being a crime and give the support to someone who has the disease. They make it difficult for them to succeed. You know, they come out, but if you have to register as a drug offender, which she did as part of her probation, well, that's going to severely limit your ability to get employment. She's fortunate that she had me and that, you know, I was willing to let her stay at the house, because otherwise she would have been homeless. She would not have been able to support herself. They make the whole thing an impediment to getting better. So there's just kind of an attitude of, well, go handle it yourself, and all we're going to do is watch you. The comparison that I can come up with is, I'm a cancer survivor. And it's like if they said to me, okay, well, you have cancer, but go fix it yourself. Oh, and by the way, if you come out of remission, that's your fault, and we're going to punish you for it. Because that's how the system works. The entire mindset has to shift from it being a crime to it being a health issue.
How long did Oksana spend in prison?
It was the better part of a year. She had spent 3 months, and then they sent her to what was supposed to be a one-year rehab program. She was much younger than most of the other women there. And she was discharged from that program, not because she was using, but basically because they didn't think she was ready and, you know, wasn't doing it the way they wanted her to. So they discharged her from the program, and then she got tossed back into jail for the next 6 months. It was pretty much a year.
Were there any supports available to her while she was in jail? Like, as opposed to...
No,
like,
absolutely not.
Sort of that rehab option or nothing?
They offered no help. And in jail, they may have had some 12-step programs, but, you know, this is a county jail, and there were times when they were in their cells 23 out of 24 hours a day.
Speaking about that lack of supports, what kind of support might have helped Oksana deal with addiction? What could have been done more by the people, by the police, by the people running the prison?
Well, with the police, she also had a problem with meth. We just covered the gambit. And I remember one time she had really had a psychotic break with the meth. She was home. She said something to me, and I was just so done with it. You know, she was like, not recognizing. She's like, are you my mother or are you Arthur? And it's like, I'm just so over it. I went, I'm Arthur. And she ran out of the house. This is around midnight, screaming down the street. So I called 911 because she was obviously having a psychotic break. So they did the only logical thing to them. They arrested her. And that got her back into the system. You know, she'd been off of probation, so suddenly she's back in the system, back on probation. It's just an unending cycle. But with what I saw when she decided that she was going to get sober, and that was in like December of 2018, and she basically did it on her own. She found a sober living house, and my sister helped pay for it, you know, supported her there. But she started to go to AA meetings again. She got a sponsor, and she got herself to the community clinic where she was hooked up with a psychiatrist who started to treat her depression and the anxiety and all the underlying stuff that fed into it to begin with. That's when she really looked like she was going to succeed. Her death was almost like this fluke thing. You know, she had taken her boyfriend to rehab that day, and she was still living in the sober living home, and she was stressed out about it. I had talked to her multiple times during the day. She was stressed about getting him there, but once he was there, she was fine. She was tired. She was excited. She'd been offered a job that she was really excited about. I talked to her at 6:30 at night, and I got home at 8:45, and she was gone. And I don't know for sure, but I truly believe that the boyfriend had left something with her. I don't know whether she knew about it or not, but she was tired. She was stressed for the moment. She decided this will help. And it took her instantly. And it wasn't even her drug of choice. It was fentanyl, which was his drug of choice. You know, she did not make it 3 steps from the bathroom sink to the end of her bed. It was that quick.
What do you want people to know or to remember about Oksana?
She was so special. I mean, and everybody thinks their kid is special, and I get that. But she was unique. She was loud. She was obnoxious. She was funny. When she was sober, there was no one like her. I have a friend who used to describe her as a Technicolor child. I mean, she was just out there. I don't think she knew. I don't think she understood the effect that she had on people. At her memorial service, the church holds, I think, under 200 people. And I thought, well, okay, my family will be there and a couple of family friends. It was standing room only. And it was just people from all aspects of her life. To me, it was amazing. It was her cheerleading coach from high school and her gymnastics coaches, her whole gymnastics team. She had 4 serious boyfriends in her life. All 4 of them were there. One even flew in from Idaho. I mean, this is a kid who had an impact on people. I mean, her probation officers showed up. And she was not on formal probation at the time. They were so affected by her death that they came to the memorial service. She just was, I don't know how else to describe it. She was special. Was from the beginning right up till the end.
Is there anything you'd say to other parents that are watching their kids go through similar struggles?
Don't give up. Your kid is in there somewhere. They're still your kid, and sometimes it's hard to see, but they're still there. I would tell parents to get support that works for them and to trust their own instincts. You need support because you can't do this alone. When she was calling me horrible names and doing horrible things, it wasn't her. It was the addiction that was talking, because the difference between sober Oksana and high Oksana were night and day. Just love them. Sometimes it's hard, but keep loving your kid, you know? And do what's right for you. And trust your gut with what's right for your kid. I know a lot of programs would have said to me, throw her out. But to me, when I knew that her core fear in life, and it came from being an adopted child and a child who was abandoned in a Russian orphanage, her fear was being abandoned. So I could never figure out how me abandoning her would help her. I could not have loved her anymore. We were extremely close. We were so close that the one thing I can say is there was nothing left unsaid between us. That's a regret I do not have. We knew where each other stood, but we loved each other intensely. Hug them, even when they're nasty and grungy and a raging drug addict. Yeah. Hug them.
If you learn anything from this podcast today, I hope it's that people who struggle with addiction are very real people with family and friends that love and care for them so much. And maybe that's obvious, it should be obvious, but so often people dealing with addictions aren't treated that way. They are more than a statistic. 1,600 lives have been lost in Saskatchewan to overdose over the past 10 years, and each one of those lives had value, not just to their family and friends, but also to the entire province. We can't arrest our way out of this problem. Addiction is a health crisis that requires health solutions. Harm reduction, addiction treatment programs, and social supports will do more to end this drug epidemic than putting people in jail cells. Let's advocate for what works and not settle for anything less. Thanks so much to Jason McCready from Prairie Harm Reduction. Jason's crew is doing fantastic work, and we're so grateful to have their advocacy and life-saving work in our province. Thank you to Megan Jasper. Your story is incredibly powerful, and you are so kind to give us a glimpse into your struggles and the incredible success that you've had. I'm grateful to have made a new friend in Susan Collins. Thank you so much, Susan, for letting us into your grief and for showing us the incredible strength that both you and Oksana have. Thanks as always to our CEO, Sean Fraser, for helping produce this episode. You are a gentleman and a scholar, sir. I tip my cap to you. I want to encourage you as we close today to connect with us on social media. We use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. We love engaging with you on those platforms. We share all sorts of articles and information there as well. And we're more than happy to have conversations with you. So please like, follow, and all that. We'll share the links in the episode notes so you know where to find us. We're always continuing to refine the podcast. So if you have suggestions, feedback, topic ideas, or maybe guest ideas or people we should have on the show, don't ever hesitate to let us know. You can connect with us on any of our social media platforms and send us a message. If you're interested in learning more about John Howard Society of Saskatchewan, visit our website at sk.johnhoward.ca. We'll be back with another episode soon. So if you're enjoying this content and you want to hear more, make sure that you subscribe and rate our podcast on whichever platform you listen on. If you listen directly at nojustice.simplecast.com, follow our social media and we'll make sure we let you know when there's a new episode. Thanks so much for hanging with us on this episode, and we'll be back with more soon. Have a great day, everybody.